and welcome back to Extra Features Interview. Today we have a fantastic lady all the way from Philadelphia, USA. Her film Stray's been out for a couple of years, and she doesn't do enough promotion on it, so she decided generously to come on the show and promote it with us. Nina Esbridge, how are you? Thank you for coming on.
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Simon. I appreciate it.
No, before we even start this film, I know you're a little hesitant. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank God.
So,
okay. Fabulous.
I know you're worried it's this and that, and I want to tell you, as an indie director, you got to be positive. This is your baby. Go with it.
Great.
And, okay. I want to discuss right off the beginning, because I am doing research on you. It was hard to find things. I found out you had a Kickstarter.
Yes. Couldn't have done it without it.
Okay, and let's discuss. Why did you go Kickstarter?
Because I am primarily a writer, not a director. I also produce. But as a woman, as an older woman, as a lesbian, I had trouble raising financing. I mean, I had been trying for 10 years and got absolutely nowhere.
Really?
A lot of the cliches are true. I don't have anybody, any family members in the industry, no connections whatsoever. I'm from a small town in Kentucky, so it was pretty impossible for me anyway. So Kickstarter was born, launched the campaign, and lo and behold, we ended up making the film for, let's just say, under $100,000, which is nearly impossible. I'm very proud of that, very proud of that. And couldn't have done it without Kickstarter.
Now, I've read some of your, I want to go through some of your Kickstarter goals, I guess, or I don't know what you call them when you hit them.
Yeah.
The person that paid the, I think it was whatever money to be a crowd scene, which one was that? Which person was it?
To be in a,
an extra in a scene. You have it listed as
yes,
one of your goals.
It was a, someone in my neighborhood who donated. You want a name?
No, I just want to know where they were.
You literally? Okay, it's fun. In the restaurant, when Sarah is discussing Jennifer with her brother, the cop, there's a woman sitting in the back and she's sipping tea.
See, that's the cool things. Don't you want to know where
yeah.
they were?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
I want to know where they were.
Absolutely.
Now, did the person just come in and sit down and go, because they've never acted before, I presume?
No, well, no, they, none of the extras were actors, no. So, no, she didn't come in and sit down. She did what I told her to do, right?
There you go.
I told her to sit down.
That's awesome. Now, did you get any Skype interviews with the Q&As for it?
No, I've never done a Skype interview.
Okay.
The questions I was asking you. No, I've never done Skype.
Because it was one of your Kickstarter goals.
Oh, that I would do a Skype. Oh, I did do that. I did not do Skype, though. I did a phone conversation.
And how did that go?
Really well. I think that it's been a while. That everybody involved with Kickstarter, as far as contributors, were really pleased. I think they expected, because our budget was so low, that they didn't expect at least the production value that we were able to achieve. Again, nothing's perfect, but we pulled off some things that normally wouldn't be pulled off on that kind of budget. And pretty much everybody involved with the Kickstarter campaign was aware of that. So everybody's been really, really generous and really kind and supportive about the whole campaign.
So you had a positive Kickstarter experience, I guess, is what I'm looking for.
Absolutely. A friend of mine who was not in film or film production, we were drinking wine on the front porch, and I was boo-hoo-hooing in my beer about how I'm never going to get a film made. And she said, let's do a Kickstarter campaign. And so I said, okay. And we did. Now, here's the problem. You don't raise much money on Kickstarter. I mean, you don't, unless you're, you know, Spike Lee, you don't raise $1 million or $2 million. So I was like, okay, let's do it. It's not going to work anyway. I'm basically a negative person, if you've not picked up on that. And so we did the campaign, and we got, I don't remember, you know, $60,000, I think, is what's on the page. And I was like, oh, terrific. Now I've gotten this much money, I have to make a film. You can't make a film for $60,000. So that, it was almost, I guess I felt kind of like Donald Trump. You're like, oh, I didn't expect to be president. Now what? but we pulled it off. We pulled it off somehow. But it scared the hell out of me when I realized, oh, my God, we met our goal.
Well, I think it's fantastic. And like I said, I'm glad your film exists. So let's get into the film. Let's discuss it. You start off the top. I find you really drop the viewer in right to the plot right off the beginning. Even though we really don't know what's going on, we know what's going to happen somewhat. Is that your plan? Like, there's no real lead-in. You just sort of drop me into the meet the character. Here you go.
Yeah, that was the plan. Absolutely. A lot of, I don't want to say weird, but when you have a little film like this, you've got to keep the viewer off guard. So, like, she is a serial killer, and her weapon of choice is a knife. So instead of a huge butcher knife, I intentionally, you know, chose a little pocket knife. Little things like that that are a little bit unusual and unexpected. I always want to tell this story from the very first scene, at least for me. For me as the filmmaker and the writer, if you pay close attention, you'll see everything you need to see in the first scene. And then throughout the rest of the film, if you watch it again and again, which God knows I have, you pick up on little things that you didn't notice before. If you don't pay attention to the film, you're not going to get it. And a lot of people did not get the film. Did not understand it. I understand that. It's a micro budget, weird micro budget. So I understand that. But if you stick with it, pay attention, I think it sends a message and a very valuable one as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you got a really beautiful train shot, I got to give you credit for. I quite like the train station. I like the train shot. And then I didn't expect you to go inside the train. So how'd you get that access?
There's something weird about that train.
Okay.
So you didn't notice. I'm in Philadelphia, as I said, and we had to travel to New Jersey and got an antique train.
Yeah, it looked old, the train, yes.
It managed to convey moving train, you know, with a green screen and everything. But obviously what I wanted to do was get an active train here in Philadelphia. That I worked on for months, and it just didn't happen. They weren't going to allow that to happen. So, you know, a lot of bumps in the road happened like that. We'd pack up and go to New Jersey and find an inactive train and hope that it passes as a train. I think it did.
It did. I mean, I noticed it was old, but I wasn't – I mean, I don't really ask. Go ahead.
It moved.
Yeah. I mean, you're an independent filmmaker. You take what you're given, and I accept that.
Exactly. But truth be told, my DP, director of photography, and he's co-producer, and a very dear friend of mine, David Landau, he pulled off a lot of the locations and obviously the crane shots and the camera work. I think he did an amazing job. I was really, really lucky to get him. And the only reason I did is because he's a dear friend. You know, he did me a favor. So he was invaluable. I mean, I couldn't have done it without him. Couldn't have done it without Kickstarter. I couldn't have done it without any of the key people involved, truly. It was my first feature as a director. And honestly, I had no idea what I was doing. No, at all. I don't want to be a director. I've never wanted to be a director. But every director that I got near that I approached to hire either wasn't available for my budget, I couldn't afford them, or they wanted to make it a sexy horror film, you know, lots of boobs and blood. And that was the opposite of what I wanted. And so I had to take on the job myself to keep that from happening. I don't believe in gratuitous sex or violence. It's just a personal thing. I don't appreciate it. I do it off the page. You may have noticed there's not a lot of blood or sex.
I don't think this film would have worked if you had done that in any way.
You say, would have or would not?
Would not. It would totally have lost the interest I would want.
Thank you. That's not – well, my distributor, Indie Rights, labeled it and put it in the horror genre. So we fought about that, but I didn't win. It is not – a horror film. If you want a horror film, go someplace else. So that pissed a lot of people off. People who are into the cult horror films thought that that's what it was going to be. Read the synopsis, and it sounds like it could be really, like I said, booby and bloody. But it's not. It's a drama. It's a thriller, dramatic thriller. So that's where I did get a lot, not a lot, but a few really bad reviews. When they're good, they're good. When they're bad, they're really, really bad. And I think that it's because of that it was placed in the wrong genre, and I think it hurt me. Did you ask me that question?
No, but I love the answer. That was a good answer. It was good.
Let it go. I felt very therapeutic.
It was good. This is what this podcast is for, the interview, to get the stuff out. I always want to discuss locations.
Okay.
As an independent, you have a bar location.
Yes.
You have a big house.
Yes.
And that's pretty much about it, I would say, that we really need to talk about.
Okay.
Did the big house serve as two purposes?
No. We used, I live on a street in an area called Chestnut Hill, and that's where the film takes place. And I live on a small street. This is really cool. When I got the Kickstarter money, it was just like, okay, I've got to make a film. Come on. We're all friends on this small street. East Mead Street is where I live. And it's an East Mead Street Productions. Because everybody on my street was involved. They gave me their homes. They provided the best food of any film I've ever worked on. They all did it for no pay. Some of them donated, you know, food and good food. I don't mean, you know, Wonder Bread. The bar scene, I mean the bar, the woman who owns that bar didn't even know me. I walked in one day. I had another location for the bar, and it fell through. A lot of that happened in this film, a lot of falling through. But I was desperate, and this bar is down the street from me. So I walked in to talk to Joanne Nikas, who's the owner of the bar, and I said, I need a bar, and she said, okay. She'd never seen me before. And she gave me the bar, I think it was, you know, Sundays and Mondays for 2 weeks. And just gave us the run of the place. It was unbelievable. And a lot of that happened. One of the locations is my own home. Big house is a friend of mine. They let us pull. You know what a camera crew looks like. We had land 30 crew members and then the actors in this home. And there were some accidents, I will say. No human was injured, but there were a lot of chipped paint, so forth and so on. But nobody got no complaints whatsoever, not from the city. We got a fire engine for free. It was amazing. They really, really were this neighborhood of Chestnut Hill. Again, couldn't have done it without them, literally.
So now I have to ask, which house is yours? The apartment?
And that's another one. A friend of a friend who said, yeah, you can come shoot in my apartment. I didn't know her. But no, not that one. The one where the scene of Jennifer sitting on the chair with a bloody knife, and there's a bloody hand in the shot, and there's a tracking shot. That's my house. The basement, my house. The kitchen, my house. I think that's about it.
Okay. You brought up the basement scene. I got to say, I really liked the way you did that. I like how the people outside said, something's smelling, and she went to the basement to check it out, and it was unplugged. I thought that was a really nice add-on to the scene.
Wow. You really did watch the movie. It reads on the page, for obvious reasons, it works. It's harder to shoot than one would think. So I'm glad me and David, the DP, we managed to work it out.
I thought that worked really well. I thought you did a little bit of, like, I noticed that in all your shooting. Your DP was amazing. I really enjoyed his shots.
Good. He's
and I
very
found
talented.
You, and maybe it was you directing him, you guys seemed to go a little bit further than some other films. Like, you, questions I kind of needed answered were there.
Oh, good.
I do have one. Let's discuss it now. I'll get into it a little bit earlier. I only have one minor issue with the script.
Right, okay.
And I'm going to bring it up. It's right. I don't want to ruin your film because I want people to see it, but there's two characters at the very end of the film.
Yes.
One, I'm still not sure. I think I know who it was, but I'm not sure who it was. Does that make sense? I don't think that person was properly introduced.
The tall guy?
Yes, right at the very end.
Okay, that is the same guy. Good catch. That is the same guy
from the beginning.
The restaurant scene. That's the police officer that is Sarah's brother. When they're sitting in the restaurant and she says, I don't know what she says, there's something not right about this woman.
Yes.
That's her brother.
Okay, I was a little confused on who that was.
Oh, okay. Thanks for letting me know.
I mean, it's a minor quibble. I enjoyed the film. I'm just like, who is this? Because I don't think they were properly introduced for me as a watcher.
The end, I didn't get to do the literally the ending. I didn't get to do what I wanted to do. We just didn't have financially the wherewithal, the time to do the ending, and that would have explained better who this guy was. His character name is Andrew. He's a police officer, and he was going to segue into, you know, straight part two. He is the one that's with Edna, the grandmother.
Yes.
Sitting there. They got into the car to go see Marvin, her husband that is in a home in New Jersey.
Okay.
When she's drunk on the couch.
That helped me out a bit. I was like, what's going on? I'm a little confused.
Yeah, that was
here.
Supposed to be expanded. We were going to see them drive off to New Jersey and literally pass Jennifer on the highway. You know, hitchhiking. We just couldn't do it. So that's a good catch. You're absolutely right. I agree with you.
Sorry about that. So, okay, so if they passed it, that would have made much more sense to me.
Good. Next time I'll do script notes with them.
No, no problem. It's just me watching the film because I make notes as I go. So
you're absolutely right.
Why do you think Jennifer does what she does? Is it because she's lonely? Or looking for something? Because I don't think we really know.
Yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
I just felt I needed a little bit more on what she was doing, her motivations. I had some idea. I have gadgets.
You want to tell me what they are?
I absolutely will tell you. I think in the beginning she was escaping a situation she wasn't happy with.
Correct.
And then that was fine. And then she met the first guy, and she was just looking for a place to stay.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I got that. Yep. And she didn't know, because she asked her, do you have a girlfriend? And he says, no, there's nobody. But he didn't really mention that. He said, I don't have a wife. But I did like the scene how the girl comes home, sees the stuff, and leaves instantly. I thought that was really different. Because usually most women look around first.
Yeah, yeah.
And she didn't. She's like, you know what? I'm done. I'm leaving. And that would be more me.
It would be me, too. There's a bra on the floor that isn't mine.
Yeah.
I'm out of here.
Yeah, and I took that as acceptable behavior.
Okay, good.
And then she discovered that she got discovered. She had to cover her tracks. Obviously, I got that. And then she had to move on. So I think she's looking for a set. I guess she wants to settle down, looking for something.
Perfect.
Like, that's what I took from it. Because, I mean, the title's called Stray.
Uh-huh.
So strays are usually looking for a home. That's usually what it means to me. Like a stray cat, a stray dog, a stray person. I can take that as a thing. So I think she was looking for a sense of belonging. Am I wrong here?
No, you're 100% correct. I think if I could have done something differently, I'm not, I'm pretty sure I'm positive about this. It would be the very last scene. What does the last scene of the film say to you as the viewer?
I feel that she's not going to find happiness. That she can't.
Okay, so let me walk you through this. Jennifer has a nightmare, right?
Yes.
And she wakes up and she says to her boyfriend, Greg, he says, you were mumbling something about Jelly Bean.
Yes.
And she says, that's a name my father used to call me.
Correct.
Fast forward to the very final scene. And he caresses her and says, don't cry, Jelly Bean.
Right. I thought that was her dad, but I wasn't sure again.
Yeah. That, I think, I needed to drive the point. I mean, I'm not sure about it because I like films that I have to watch a couple of times to fully understand. That's me personally.
I would have to watch this twice because I wouldn't concentrate on Jennifer as much. I would try to figure out other things I'm missing, like Sarah and stuff like that. I would have to pay a little bit more attention to surrounding characters.
What this film is really about for me, because I don't personally care for horror films. I do like thrillers. I don't like killer films. That's not my style. But here I am making my first film, and I'm trying to be, you know, as smart about it as I can and fit it in, excuse me, into a genre that I know is popular. And I think, you know, thriller is. So what the story is really about for me, it's almost a metaphor. Children who experience abuse at a very early age don't become serial killers necessarily. Jennifer did. This man kidnapped her as a child. He is her father. We're giving away all the talk about spoiler, but he is her father, and he has had her since she was a young child. That's what when the young child in the film is trying to wake up her mother, that child is Jennifer.
Okay.
Her father murdered her mother.
Uh-huh.
And kidnapped her, and they've been on the run for what, you know, 10 years, 10, 15 years. And she says at some point in the film, we drove and we drove.
Yes.
And I finally figured out all I needed to do was walk away.
Yeah.
The very first scene that you see is her walking away from her father.
That's what
I figured. That's where he runs. And the rest of the film is about him chasing her, tracking her down. In the end, it's her choice to go back to him. So to me, as the writer and the filmmaker, it is more a metaphor, as I said, in the sense that children who are molested oftentimes, especially females, have issues with relationships throughout the rest of their life. Not all people who were molested become serial killers or are unable to lead fulfilling lives, but a good number, a good percentage of them don't. They destroy every relationship that they have, from family to partners to children. Sort of fruit of the poisonous tree, if you will. That's what Jennifer is doing. She's destroying figuratively, literally in the film, for me as the writer, figuratively, everybody she meets, she kills them, except for her father and her child. That's why she left her child with someone else. The child is her father's child. He is the father of this child.
Yeah, again, we figured it. We knew that.
A couple of times to figure that out, maybe.
No, Sarah told us that.
I hope so.
She said, that's not your child. So I didn't know whose it was. I was kind of like, could be somebody else's, but I thought it might be the guy she slept with beforehand.
Well, that's what he is supposed to think. That is why she crashes into his life, seduces him immediately, has sex so that he will believe that the child is his.
Well, I knew that. That made sense.
Yeah. You hit the nail on the head. She is looking for a place to settle up. She's looking for home. She's looking for a place to nest to have her child. She wants to keep this child, she implies, in the alleyway with the father that this has happened before, that she's had other children. So she wants to find a place where she can raise this child, have a family, settle down, and she just can't do it. She can't pull it off. And that, again, is metaphor for those who have been abused, specifically in the situation by their parents, father here, that she will never be able to have a successful relationship or family. Her ghosts, if you will, follow her for the rest of her life. And that's who Sai, the father, was. The ghost that follows her everywhere. You can never get rid of the damage that is done via child abuse.
Okay, we got to move on to something a little bit lighter here. This is heavy. How do you feel writing this then? Like, this is some heavy stuff.
God.
Like, was this just inside you and poured out, or was this a year process, 5 year process, a week? I don't know.
Oh, it was about, I'd say 15 years. It was based, originally, the screenplay was based on a true story. I wanted to, when I was a child, growing up in Owensboro, Kentucky, a young child was murdered, and that didn't happen in Owensboro. You know, it just never happened, so it was a big deal, and this guy who murdered this young child ended up in a psychiatric hospital for, you know, a year, then released. After doing research, I found that out. So I was like, okay, where is this guy? Not literally, but where this guy could get on a bus and travel anywhere he wants to. He's obviously got issues, and what would happen? So he gets on a bus and he ends up in Chestnut Hill. Okay, that was the first screenplay. I wrote the whole thing with it as a male serial killer. It was boring, and that tells a lot right there. That delivers a message. But it was boring. The story's been told before. I didn't like it. And so I thought, I've changed the killer to a woman. Okay, fine. That was much more interesting. And as I did research, I realized, you know, whether it's Eileen Warnes or, you know, the other one or two serial killers, female serial killers, that they were all abused. Physically and sexually. And so that's what helped me develop the story. And I want to deliver, you know, a very heavy message. I think you have to. I wanted to, but also with a micro-budget film, you have to have a punch. You don't have the physical action because you can't afford special effects. So you have to have a powerful punch in the story. And that was part of it, too. I wanted to do that, but I also wanted to deliver a message. Don't mess with your kids, okay?
I agree. I do want to touch
on... I can see you're upset there, being a parent.
No, it's all good. Let's discuss your fire scenes. You do two of them in the film.
Mm-hmm.
How were those to shoot, since you've never done anything before like that?
Bells and whistles, you know, smoke and mirrors. That house was next door to the house that I live in, okay? My sister happens to live there, so I said, I'm shipping you off. I'm going to go into your apartment and set it on fire. Is that okay? She said, that's fine. She said, no problem.
Really?
yes. She loves me, and she wanted this film to be made. So what we did is we got a smoke machine, and David is the pro with this. He set up, you know, smoke bombs in the windows, and then we did that in post. His daughter is a post specialist. She does animation and special effects. So she pulled that off for us with the smoke. I thought it looked pretty good.
It did look pretty good. I was pretty convinced. I'm like, how did they do that?
It was not easy, and my sister lost a few pieces of furniture, but it worked out in the end.
Was she okay with losing furniture?
Every once in a while, she'll point at something and say, that wasn't there before the film. Yeah, you know, whenever she's feeling, you know, feisty. I'll make it up to her at some point.
Oh, that's great. Where did the film premiere?
When or where?
Where?
At a festival in Florida, Tampa Film Festival, something like that. It did not get a theatrical release.
I thought you would have told me it had a big thing in the town. You guys had an outdoor screen. You set it up and down and showed it to everybody.
And that. We did that, too. No, we did, actually. We did. We did not do it in the neighborhood. They were pretty sick of us by the time we were finished. You know, our neighbors were like, okay, that was fun, but that's enough. So the sound editor, John Alvarez, teaches at Drexel University. He teaches sound in Drexel. And we went to Drexel and had the, you know, the cast and the neighbors and the crew. And that was the first time that I ever got to see it on the screen. That was fun.
And that was, you loved it?
I have seen this film so many times.
I know.
I'm over it, okay? No, all you see are mistakes. When you make a film, I mean, you know that. All you see is what you did wrong. Very rarely do you see what you did right. The fact that you understood and appreciated the story means a lot.
Oh. So I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to put you on the spot.
All right.
Your favorite catered meal made by a neighbor?
Was the Korean chicken.
Now, are you still friends with this neighbor?
Oh, why? Yeah, why?
Because I figured you would go over and get some more.
She moved. Actually, I do. She lives, you know, a couple of miles away. She's no longer on the street. But I do. I ask her. I say, would you please make that again? And she doesn't. But we had lasagna. We had, I'm a vegetarian. So they would make, you know, things for me. And then they would make these amazing 3 meals a day.
Wow.
3 meals a day they would cook. And something that is interesting about this film is it was shot with a lot of students. As I said, the DP, David Landau, is a teacher at FDU, Fairleigh Dickinson University. And he got students to fill – we've got professionals to do all of the key positions. You know, DP, production manager, AD, we're all professionals. But we got his students – to fill in the other positions. So we're housing, you know, 30 kids here in Chestnut Hill. Somebody gave their house up for me to put these kids in, and then the other neighbors cooked for them. And they just loved the food. It was amazing. Catering is always the biggest issue, and I am so proud of the catering.
So where did you find your actors for the film?
Adrian Stern is a casting director. I had an actress that had been with the film for years, you know, like 10 years. She aged. She moved through characters, and she finally came the age to play the lead. And she dropped out, of course, you know, 2 months before we were to begin shooting. I was going to shut down production. It hadn't even started. So I went to Adrian Stern, and she introduced me to Gabrielle Stone. And I'm just really lucked out, seriously, because she's in every scene. That's all I can say is I really lucked out thanks to Adrian Stern.
I think she does a good job because she's not – I know it's a bad thing to say. She's not too pretty, not too ugly. She looks
– Exactly.
I know it's a bad thing to say.
Actresses of that age, you know, they want to be pretty, and I understand that. But she got, you know, a little concerned every once in a while when I'd see her putting on, you know, mascara. I'm like,
no.
This character would never wear makeup.
No, she's exactly what I expect her to be. Just blow in, show up, I need a job.
Exactly.
I gotta do, and I thought Sarah, no, so I'm getting confused. Sarah.
Mm-hmm. Was a little Samantha bit, Walsh.
Yeah, it was a little bit more wishy-washy than I would have wanted, but it worked.
Mm-hmm.
That's just for me as a friend. I couldn't have hung out with her. I know the bartender's dating her. I would have had some issues, but that was just me. She's a little wishy-washy for me.
Now, you mean the actress or you mean the character?
I mean the character's a little wishy-washy. The actress is fine. It's just when she said, you've done this before, and she still wants to be with him, I'm like, but, come on, it's time to go.
Well, she's supposed to be wishy-washy, but she's the first one that figures it out.
She is, because she's observing, I think. She figures it out.
Yeah.
She's about 5 steps away, and he's too close.
He is a man. You know, that's all I can say about that.
Well, I'm a man, too, and I would not have made those choices. So.
I wouldn't have cast you in the movie.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't have done a good job. I'm not a good actor. I'm a very good interviewer, but I'm not so good. Okay. I really have. Oh, I have one more question. Where to find your film? Tell people.
The best place to find it is on Amazon Prime. You can watch it for free, and the quality is really good.
Quality is fantastic.
I'm sorry?
The quality, if it's what you sent me, the quality is fantastic.
I sent you Vimeo.
Yes.
And it's pretty good. Vimeo's pretty good. But I think Amazon Prime, the quality is quite good considering, you know, everything. It's also available on Google and the other platforms. But Amazon Prime is really where I recommend viewers to go if they're interested.
Are you ready for fun questions?
I'm ready.
Even though you've heard other interviews, I'll be nice because you don't want me to change them, so I'll be nice.
No, you do whatever you want.
Favorite film?
Badlands, 1977, Terrence Malick's first film.
I've seen it. The accents fit for you perfectly, that film.
It sure does. I love that film. Yeah, and Days of Heaven, which is his second film.
I have not seen Days of Heaven yet, but I will one day.
Yeah. I think that probably he is. I guess he's my favorite director.
So I'm going to have to go. I'm just going to go. I'm presuming you're a huge Sissy Spacek fan.
I am.
So what did you think of Coal Miner's Daughter then?
I loved it. I thought it was fabulous. You didn't like it?
I loved it.
Okay. I think that she is probably one of the most versatile actresses that we have. I mean, she is Southern, so that's why she does such a great accent. But she can play sexy, she can play Coal Miner's Daughter. I mean, I really do appreciate her a lot.
So, did the Malick bring you, just to go back to the Malick thing, is his cinematography shooting that does it? I mean, he does do get a depth of lens. I don't know how else to say it.
I'm sorry, you dropped out.
Sorry, depth of field, depth of lens. Whenever I've watched him, everything seems massive wherever he's shooting. Everything just seems big.
David and I, the cinematographer, have been friends forever. He got me my first film job in New York City. We both lived in New York at the time. And we have been dear friends ever since, and we constantly talk about working together. And we did work together on industrials and so forth, so on and so forth like that. But this was the first feature we got to work on together. So we know each other. And we started out in film. So I've watched him grow and progress, which you have to do as a photographer, into digital HD. And he knows that I prefer film, and so does he. So we worked really hard, him harder than me, in making it look like film. And I think he did, considering we used two Sony cameras, I think he did a marvelous job.
I agree.
And he knows what he's doing with depth of field, lighting, you know, green screen. He knows what he's doing.
Okay, I'm going to rephrase my second question because you live in a small town.
Okay.
Somebody's going to loan you a field and a gigantic projector. What film are you going to put on it to show the whole town?
The town that I live in?
Yes.
Probably Days of Heaven. Either Days of Heaven or Wanda. Barbara Loden's film.
I've never seen. What's Wanda?
You have to find it, and it's impossible to find.
I'll find it.
Then find it. I've tried to buy it. I just can't find it. I'd be interested in what you have to say about it.
Okay.
But those are one of the two films I would show.
These you like these questions. Third question. Since we had a great catering, you had a great thing, we have the whole town set up to watch Wanda. Who's catering it? What concessions are we going to have?
For Wanda?
Yeah.
Gosh, probably, since you haven't seen the film, you won't get it, but probably meatloaf, mashed potatoes, and collard greens.
I love collard greens.
Really?
I love them.
I can't believe you know what they are.
I love Southern barbecue, so I've had collard greens numerous times.
And probably some hair rollers would be on the table. You'll have to see the film to figure out what that means.
I will. I'm going to have to go look for it after this interview for a couple of minutes. I think that's it for me. Unless I've missed something, I want to thank you for your time, and you were fantastic.
Thank you, Simon. This was actually fun. I was terrified.
I know.
Well, you couldn't, you know, you didn't indicate whether you liked the film or had even seen the film or, you know, and it's, it could be anything.
But
this was fun.
I always watch the film. I promise anybody I ever interview, I watch the film and I take notes. Like I
now
you.
I know that. I know that's true, and I can't wait till my next film.
Well, let's finish off there. Do you have another film coming?
I am working on almost finished with my next screenplay, and then we the whole process again. I am not doing a micro-budget film again. I am too old, so I will have to get a decent budget, you know, at least $1 million, you know, at least. And, yeah, I'll be finished with that soon. And no Kickstarter. Wow. None of that. No family and friends. No street people making catering. I can't do that again. It was fun, but I'll never do it again. Nobody killed me.
Well, thank you again for your time. And everybody go see Stray on Amazon Prime. It's fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.